Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, is former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich responsible for damaging the culture and productivity of the U.S. Senate? Then, scholars analyze the role of comedy in politics. Can one person change a long-established institution and destroy its culture? Our next guest says yes and argues that former House Speaker Newt Gingrich has been that person to the U.S. Senate. Through Gingrich's tactics and political activities, the Senate is unrecognizable to past senators and scholars who have studied the body. What exactly was Gingrich's role in damaging the Senate's culture and productivity? Sean Theriault joins us. Sean Theriault is a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention, and Voter Retribution, Party Polarization in Congress, and his latest, The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress. Welcome, Sean Theriault.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. This book, The Gingrich Senators, you're documenting essentially what you see as the turn of the Senate in particular into this very polarized body. You started with a particular vignette. I thought it was a really great way to illustrate it with Senator DeMint. Tell us what happened and how that sort of illustrates what you saw happening.
What we have coming out of the 2008 election is the Republican Party is split because they see that Obama won in a pretty huge way. And so half of the Republicans in the Senate thought that they needed to go along with Obama, kind of get on board with some of the agenda items that he had. But then the other half of the Republican Party thought that he needed to be stopped at every turn. And so early on, there's a Republican conference meeting, and Jim DeMint makes it his priority that he's going to stop Obamacare. And so coming out of that Republican conference, when he announces his opposition, Republicans are furious at him because they think that they need to still play the conciliatory game with Obama. And DeMint says, no, we need to stop them at every cost. And so what happens is that Jim DeMint ends up being the primary force that stops Obama on lots of his different agenda items, certainly makes Obamacare much more difficult. But not only Obamacare, but also the financial overhaul bill becomes much more difficult because of him. Environmental legislation becomes much more difficult. And what we get by the end of that Congress is the entire Republican Party almost on board with Jim DeMint's agenda, and it becomes wrapped up into the Tea Party, and we have the 2010 election, where after the 2010 election, the entire Republican Party is transformed, not only in the Senate, but in the House as well because of the Tea Party. And we can trace it almost exactly to Jim DeMint and who he supports and how they do in the 2010 election.
And you trace him and the other what you call Gingrich senators to 1978 was when you brought Newt Gingrich into the stage.
Right.
What was it that characterized Newt Gingrich? First of all, he was in the House. He wasn't even in the Senate. But this ended up getting into the Senate.
That's right. So what Newt Gingrich does, he brings a different style of politics to Washington, D.C. Because before Newt Gingrich, the Republicans thought that they were a permanent minority. And so they thought that the only way that they were going to have an influence on legislation was if they got along with the Democratic chairs of the committees, if they offered their amendments and perhaps got some conservative Democrats to go along with them, and that they would have their influence in very marginal ways. And Newt Gingrich comes in and says, look, if we want to be a major player in this town, we have to stop cooperating. We need to get in front of Democrats, try and stop them at every turn, give the voters a clear choice, and then what we can hope to do is ride the unpopularity of Congress to electoral victory. And what happens 2 years after Newt Gingrich introduces this new style of politics, if we have Ronald Reagan winning. When Ronald Reagan wins in 1980, he brings with him a bunch of Republicans into the Senate. And Republicans are finally the majority party, not only in the White House, but in the Senate as well. And the problem for the House Republicans is they look at their friends who are in the Senate and they see them chairing committees. They look down at the White House. They see a Republican in the White House, but yet they're still in the minority. And they will be in the minority for 14 years. But it's only through the persistent efforts of Newt Gingrich over those 14 years to differentiate the House Republicans from the House Democrats, that ultimately we get this huge wave in 1994 that brings the Republicans to the majority party. And it's all because of the politics of confrontation that Newt Gingrich introduces.
Let's talk about how he did that. There was a particular, it wasn't a caucus, it was the
Conservative Opportunity Society.
That's right.
That's right. The Conservative Opportunity Society. And what he does is he gets some of the backbencher Republicans who are sick of playing along with the Democrats and only having a marginal influence in legislation, and he starts forming this informal group. And they start are changing the way that the House operates as an institution. So instead of going on to the House floor before the official legislation happens or at the end of a legislative day, where other members of Congress might talk about the local Little League team or the local newspaper that's been in business for 50 years, you start having the Conservative Opportunity Society, all led by Newt Gingrich, start talking about all of the horrible ways in which the Democrats are leading the House of Representatives. And what's happening is they're doing this in front of an empty House chamber. No one else is there except for the presiding officer. And so what people on the TV screen see is only this person railing against Democrats, and they don't ever see that the chamber is completely empty.
And this was C-SPAN.
C-SPAN, right. And so C-SPAN has the person saying all these horrible things about Democrats. People who are watching it don't know that the Republicans aren't there to rebut the charges. And so they say, well, the Democrats aren't there rebutting the charges, so they must be true. And so the fight, of course, escalates because then at one point you have the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, who says that he's going to start panning the audience, and he doesn't tell the Republicans this. And so you'll have a Republican who's all red in the face because they're speaking with such gusto, and then it shows in a completely empty House chamber. And of course, then Newt Gingrich gets involved, and there's an entire fight that happens on the floor of the House, Newt Gingrich versus Tip O'Neill. And ultimately what happens is Tip O'Neill is applauded by all the Republicans in the House, except for a select few, including the House Minority Leader.
You said Tip O'Neill.
Oh, I'm sorry, right. So Newt Gingrich was applauded by many of the Republicans, but one Republican who's not applauding is Bob Michael, who's the Republican leader in the House still, because he's one of these people who said the only way that we're going to get things accomplished in the House of Representatives is we get along with Democrats. And he sees his entire strategy being confronted by Newt Gingrich, and he sees that he's losing control of his conference.
It wasn't even so much just to go along to get along, it seemed. It was just the entire decorum that Congress had become, which was, yeah, you can have these arguments about policy on the floor, but people then would dine together and get along together, and they weren't vicious.
And before this, it was very typical for a person to win in their 30s or 40s, their first election, and move the entire family, pack up the car, move everyone to Washington, D.C. And so what you would have is Democrats living right next to Republicans. Their children would play on the same Little League teams, they would go to school together. And so there was lots of social glue to kind of help the new members congeal once they got to Washington. But one of the things that Newt Gingrich does as soon as he comes to Washington is do not move here, because then you become part of this massive Washington, D.C. establishment, which we're going to run against. Instead, go home on the weekends, come to D.C., stay overnight actually in your office, use the showers in the House gym, stay here for two or three nights, and then go back to your districts. And that way we can portray the Democrats as being out of touch, being captured by the Washington, D.C. establishment. And to Newt Gingrich's credit, wildly successful, right? 1994, he becomes Speaker of the House because of the elections that happened that year.
And he did manage to topple the Democratic leader.
He did.
At the time.
That's right. Yep. So not only does he become Speaker, but the previous Speaker loses in the 1994 election. Tom Foley, the previous Speaker, the Democrat, loses in that election in a district in eastern Washington. Speaker Wright is Speaker, and Newt Gingrich rails against him for having the sweetheart book publishing deal. And it's a little bit ironic that this becomes the main criticism that Gingrich has used against Speaker Wright, because it's ultimately what in help causes Newt Gingrich's downfall in the late 1998 sweetheart publishing deal. Conflict escalates.
He becomes Speaker, but he sees that, as you said, his third priority.
That's right.
What were his real priorities?
Yeah, so for the first time, really, a Speaker doesn't see themselves as being an institutionalist, the head of the whole House of Representatives, but rather, first and foremost, he is the leader of this movement, the movement in America to reform politics. And secondly, he views himself as the leader of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. And third, of course, is the Speaker of the House. It's interesting, though, because that I think that Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner are certainly more institutionalists than Newt Gingrich was. But I think both of them would view themselves equally as being in charge of the House of Representatives and the leader of their party. I think that they can't ever lose sight of the fact that they are the leader of the party because of the way that Newt Gingrich transforms what a Speaker is supposed to do and be.
So in essence, what you then saw is all of these Republicans who were essentially trained by Newt Gingrich coming into the House and then moving to the Senate, right? But they're inspired by this tape that he's also put out there.
So Newt Gingrich, leading up to the 94 election, starting as early as the early 1980s, he's not only recruiting candidates to run, not only for the House of Representatives, but he's going even more local than that. He recognizes that in order to become a majority party in the House, you need to have qualified candidates run. In order to get qualified candidates, you need to start running good Republicans in city council elections, for county seats, at the local level. And he's not only recruiting candidates, but he's also telling them how to campaign. And he says, these are action words. These are words that you want to use because it's going to make you sound proactive. It's going to make you sound energetic. Don't use these words because they sound tired. They're going to play into the way that Democrats talk about issues. Instead, we need to transform, right? We need to not talk about global warming, but rather climate change is an example of this. But we see how important these tapes are, even in the 2012 presidential election, when Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum are on stage together in the debates. And Rick Santorum says how instrumental and influential those early tapes were to how he thinks about politics. So here he is now, 25 years later, still being influenced by those early tapes that Newt Gingrich had given him even before he was in the House of Representatives.
And now we have, 40 senators that you call Gingrich senators that are sitting in the chambers now?
That's right. I think just two more. So 42.
So we have 42.
42. So Tim Scott and Jeff Flake.
I was very surprised that John McCain was one of them.
Yeah, isn't it interesting? John McCain has always been a tough case. I've been working on this project for 7-8 years, and there are times where I was like, oh man, John, he's everything that a Gingrich senator isn't. And then every now and then, he acts exactly as a Gingrich senator does. And it's then that I see that even in the genetic makeup of who John McCain is as a senator, sometimes it's too hard for him to resist those Gingrich lessons that everyone learned when they were in the House of Representatives.
He does cross over now and then. And
he does.
And part of what seems to be the sort of Gingrich senator manifesto is confront, block, and demean at every possible occasion.
That's right. Because it's the only way that they're going to become a majority party.
I think you called them both party polarizers and partisan warriors. Seems like that would almost be one and the same.
Yeah.
How are they different?
Right. How are they different? So it's one thing to vote conservatively. It's another thing to demean. And it's another thing to obstruct. And so they are certainly party polarized. They're conservative. In fact, of the 42 people who've been Gingrich senators who've served in the Senate, only two of them have been more moderate than the average Republican that they're serving with in the Senate. So just 2 out of 42. The other 40 have all been more conservative than the average Republican that they're serving with. And so certainly they vote conservatively. That's part of the story. But then there's another dimension, and that's to obstruct. It's sometimes to demean. Not everyone, of course, demeans, but it's obstruct. It's making things much more difficult than they otherwise need to be. It's not compromising at any level. In fact, it's standing in the way of compromise, making it more difficult for the compromisers to compromise with Democrats.
And it's primarily, it seems like, to make the other party look bad.
It is. It is. That's right. And what happens is that the margins, both in the House and the Senate, since 1994 have shrunk. And so every single election cycle since 1994, we're never quite sure which party's going to be in the majority. The one exception perhaps is 2008, when we were pretty certain that the Democrats were going to be, or in 2002 when we thought the Republicans were. But every other election cycle, we always think that the majority is up for grabs in the House and in the Senate. And so that introduces something into the dynamic of the way the institution operates, because it means, all right, if we compromise with Democrats, if we let them get this victory, that becomes something that they're going to be able to use against us. And so it's far better for us to stand in the way, make sure nothing good happens, hope that we become the majority party, so then we can drive the bus in the next Congress.
Similarly, as we've been saying, they've been blocking nominations. You say they have like this PAC mentality where they co-sponsor each other's bills, but nobody else's.
That's right.
Describe how the legislative process has actually changed and what the policy outcomes are.
No, that's right. So really interesting, and you have to be a pretty close observer of the Senate to see some of these changes. Of course, we all hear about cloturers and filibusters, but what's also happening in the Senate today is what they call death by amendment. And it's this endless introduction of amendments, forcing the leaders to go through 40 or 60 or 120 different amendments before they can finally take a final passage vote. And lots of these amendments have nothing to do with the underlying piece of legislation. Lots of them are strictly to get a Democrat to cast a vote on the wrong side of the issue so that their future competitor can run a campaign commercial that says, this person voted for tax increases 27 times. And then they can show all the times they have. And it's only because they're playing legislative games. Lots of these amendments have no chance of passing, but yet they still do it because taking a roll call on the floor of the Senate can take up to a half hour because you're still calling everyone's name by name by name. And so it takes a long time. And so they're standing in the way.
It's no wonder that the senators who were not of that ilk, the kind of more moderate Republicans especially, have left.
Right. Olympia Snowe, right, on the way out, just can't even recognize not only the Senate as it's operating as an institution, but even her own conference, even the Republican conference. She admits as much on her way out the door, and she's grateful that she moves beyond. She thinks that she can have more influence from the outside.
Well, we'll see.
We will see. And I think it's always easy on your way out the door to criticize all of your former colleagues. It's far harder to do that when you could actually have some
unless
type of
you're
influence.
A Gingrich senator. You're listening to The Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with Sean Theriault about the so-called Gingrich senators. So there are a couple more examples I wanted to go into. One was when we were talking about the nominations that the president makes for their own cabinet and their own people. One example used was President Clinton's appointment to the Surgeon General.
Surgeon General. Right. What you have with Clinton's Surgeon General nominees is the first person he nominates is Joycelyn Elders. So here's a woman who's the granddaughter of sharecroppers, right? An African-American woman in the South who makes her way all through medical school at a time where there aren't many women, there aren't many African-Americans, let alone many African-American women. But ultimately, it's a fight to get her nomination confirmed. There are all sorts of people who are throwing up roadblocks. And sure enough, when you look at every one of the people who are throwing up roadblocks, every single one of them is a Gingrich senator. And so they're ultimately starting this campaign against her.
And do you get the sense it was organized?
It certainly was organized to get in the way of Joycelyn Elders. But what's never been explicitly clear to me is that the Gingrich senators look at each other and say, you're one of us, here's a wink and a nod, and we're going to get along. I think it's just much more of at the chromosomal genetic level at which they're learning politics in the House of Representatives, and they recognize, they're like, that guy thinks a lot about politics the way I do. You know, I bet we can get along on a lot of these different issues. And so there's this very, I think, informal network that starts developing among them.
And they did have a lot of common characteristics, too.
Oh, for sure. So when Jim DeMint, who we talked about earlier, resigns his seat, we get the first Gingrich senator who is not a white male, right? So Tim Scott, who takes over Jim DeMint's seat as an African-American, and he's the first person who's not a white male. And certainly the Senate, right, isn't short for white males. But there are plenty of Republican women in the Senate, and none of them came from the House in the era of Newt Gingrich. So the one that could come to mind is Olympia Snowe, who actually enters the House just before Newt Gingrich does.
Right. So what about the Alaska and Murkowski?
Right. So Lisa Murkowski, right? She was a member of her own House in Alaska, but she never went through the House of Representatives.
Right.
And she certainly becomes ultimately a victim of the Tea Party senators, who I argue has a direct connection to the Gingrich senators.
Yeah, what is that connection? Some are maintaining their positions, but some of them are fading out.
That's right. So the Tea Party has been fascinating because as I was working on this project, I kept being more and more concerned that my class of Gingrich senators was going to fade into the background because of this new wave of Tea Party senators. And what we find is the Tea Parties couldn't have nearly the success that they had unless if it were for the Gingrich senators.
They were the trailblazers?
That's right. So two reasons, right? Certainly one, trailblazers. So they introduce a whole new series of strategies and tactics in the Senate that when the Tea Party comes along, they say, yeah, we see our friends who have done this. Now we're going to take that two or three more steps and we're going to push it even more. So there's that direct connection. But the second one is Jim DeMint. So Jim DeMint early on recognizes these new reformers in the Republican Party who can shake things up. And so he starts planning all sorts of money in their campaigns. He by far contributes more to Republican senatorial campaigns than any other Republican senator. And it's only because of the direct influence of Jim DeMint that these people are winning their primaries. They're ultimately coming into the Senate, and they adopt Jim DeMint's politics.
They also have loyalty to him after all that.
Absolutely, they do. And it's been fascinating for me to watch the dynamic that's happening in the Senate now that Jim DeMint has left. And what I think you see is some of these new Tea Party senators are picking up the Jim DeMint mantle, and they're carrying it forward, right? So clearly on the in the media front, you have Rand Paul, and then, of course, my own senator in Texas, Ted Cruz, who are absolutely out in front of the media. But you have Mike Lee, who's not someone who's on lots of TV screens or in newspapers, but absolutely doing all of the internal stuff that Jim DeMint was doing that makes compromise much more difficult, that is introducing roadblocks to getting legislation passed.
There was another incident that illustrates another tactic that I thought was quite fascinating and really important that we don't see in the public eye, and that was how they changed what you call the goalposts. in the middle of negotiations. One of these was with Obama's attempt to negotiate the reduction of arms treaty. What happened?
Yeah, so what happens is that for years and years, the main person in the Senate's look to for anything having to do with nuclear arms reduction was Dick Lugar. So Dick Lugar has always been the point person for the Republican Party. And what happens when Obama wants to do the New START is lots of Republicans start saying, you know, we're not going to listen to Dick Lugar. He has been a professed friend of Obama, and we can't have anyone that's friendly with the president be our point person. But furthermore, he represents the old Republican Party. And so they say our new spokesperson and our new point person on nuclear arms reduction is going to be John Kyle. And John Kyle did not serve on the appropriate committee that's hearing the New START. John Kyle had never been in the military himself. His background and knowledge of military systems was much less than Dick Lugar's, but yet he becomes the point person. And so he comes up with a list of 5 to 7 different demands. And he says, I'm not going to sign off on this unless if you do these things. And Obama says, all right, you want this? I'll do this, plus I'll do more for you on that score. Item 2, I'll meet you there. Item 3, I'll do this and I'll go for
it. Because he's a compromise
guy.
That's
right. And so at the end of the day, he wants a new start. And if that means that he has to increase the amount of funding available for the arms, he's going to do it. If that means a closer eye on exactly what Russia's doing, he's going to ensure that there's that closer eye because he needs John Kyle's support. And so he agrees to all of this. And John Kyle ultimately says, you know what, there's just not enough time to evaluate this. And furthermore, the Obama team hasn't been as upfront with me as I wish they had been. And so Obama lists all of the different meetings that people in the White House have had with John Kyle, where they've talked him through all the different agreements, and John Kyle still doesn't sign off. And what happens in New START is there's enough Republicans, not very many Gingrich senators, incidentally, who ultimately decide that they're going to go with not only Obama, but also Dick Lugar, who becomes a big advocate of the START treaty, and it passes in a lame duck session days before the Congress ends.
So this could explain part of Obama's shift in his approach also,
because
he has no chance in this setting.
So, and it's right. You know, Obama is just mystified, and we can see the mystification that he feels, because at time he's like,
even though he was in the Senate with a lot of them.
He was in the Senate with a lot of them, but he had a good working relationship with several Republicans when he comes. I mean, he and John McCain, once again, they're frenemies. They got along well on some issues, and then they had dueling press releases over campaign finance reform at one point. But Obama is caught between the strategy because he sees a Republican Party where some of the members are ready to compromise, and he sees a Republican Party where none of the members would ever compromise with him. And so one day he's having dinner with them, and then the next day he's castigating them in front of the media because he just doesn't know which Republicans he can possibly get on board, and if there's enough of them that can ultimately
was part of them pulling the rug out from under him?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So they're playing games with him?
Sure, they're playing games with him. But to their credit, I mean, Obama's not reaching out to them at the early stages as much as they would like. I think even who I term the other Republicans would say that. But nonetheless, the Olympia Snows of the world, the Bob Corkers of the world, the Dick Lugars of the world, all those people who didn't come from Newt Gingrich's house are willing to sit down at a table with Obama. And Obama, at the end of the day, is a pragmatic problem solver. And, you know, Obama's looking down at the Senate now, and he's looking at the Republicans who are left, and he's like, I'm not seeing many of those people left that I can talk to.
When you're talking about some of the other characteristics of them, you talked about their religion, their occupation, and very different from the past.
That's right.
Senators.
That's right.
And even this semi-secret religious organization,
that's right.
Which, by the way, I thought that some Democrats were part of.
There are some Democrats who are part of
even
it.
Even I heard Hillary Clinton.
Famously Hillary Clinton. It goes by different names in the media, the family, the fellowship is another name that it goes by. And people say that they, at the end of the day, are the people who are orchestrating all of these Republican tactics and everything that happens. And I take that hypothesis quite seriously in the book. And I say, all right, if that's true, I'm going to code all these people who have some association with the fellowship, and I'm going to see if their behavior changes. And lo and behold, when I compare them to the Gingrich senators are much more distinct from the other Republicans who are serving in the Senate than even the fellowship are. And so, however insidious some critics of the fellowship might think the fellowship is as an organization, the Gingrich senators are so much more distinct in the way.
So, do they all share a religion, or
no? So, I think that there are.
So they're mostly the evangelical.
They're mostly Protestants. There are certainly a couple of Catholics, including Newt Gingrich, who famously converts to Catholicism. Rick Santorum is another Catholic.
And then another thing you noted was most of them, unlike the previous batch of senators, were not lawyers.
Right.
And they had some military service.
So they did, but the folks that came before them had more service typically. A lot of them come from business, were successful business people. And so that reformist, that anti-regulation, low tax ideology that they profess certainly rings true to their personal lives and the experiences that they've had. And so they're clearly receptive to Newt Gingrich's message on those ideological grounds.
I was wondering about the current House now compared to the Senate and how many of, say, the John Boehners and those types also sort of cut their teeth on Newt Gingrich ideology. They certainly walk like a Gingrich senator,
right,
even though they're in the House instead.
They certainly do,
Is there a big wave of them that are being trained as we speak?
For sure. So what happens is that in my investigation of the Gingrich senators, what I find is that it didn't matter if they served in the House for 2 years or 4 years or 6 years. It didn't matter if they served on the same committees as Newt Gingrich. It didn't matter if they came after he became speaker, before he became speaker. It was just being in the Republican conference that had been radically transformed by Newt Gingrich. And so no doubt, even those people who don't go on to the Senate enter that same Republican conference that was radically transformed, including John Boehner, case in point. But what happens to John Boehner is this mentality exists for lots of years, but then we get to the 2010 election and the introduction of the Tea Party. And the Tea Party is certainly a new breed that John Boehner is like, whoa, like, I just got my hands wrapped around this mentality of Gingrichness, and now I have an entirely new set of folks that I have to try and figure out how I can try and be a leader to them. And I think that he's been dumbfounded these past few years in trying to figure out how it is that he can lead a Republican conference that has a lot of these Gingrich senators, but also people who've taken that message and walked two steps to the right in our Tea Party folks.
What does it say about the electorate that they keep putting these people back in office?
That's right.
And do you see that continuing in the future? Or do you see like such wreckage coming out of this?
What I do in the conclusion is I say, for those of you that like the Republican Party being confrontational, standing up for its beliefs, getting in the way of compromise, congratulations. Like, that is the party that you now have. And if you're Republican and you don't like that, then you need to employ the exact same instrument that Jim DeMint did. When he didn't like the kind of Republicans that he was serving with, he went to the electorate and said, I want you to send me some new breed folks. The electorate listened to him. They responded, and new breed Republicans were elected. So to the Republicans today who don't like the way the Republican Party is going, they need to take back their party. They need to show up in primaries. They need to make sure that these Main Street moderate Republicans who continue to run are elected and then have a chance of winning the general election. Until the electorate makes that decision, we're going to continue to have crash and burn politics, brinksmanship, striking deals at the 11th hour or even after the 12th hour has expired, and then making
And you left out like the whole other side of U.S. electorate, which are people who don't really agree with the Republican politics in the first place.
That's right. We don't find the bifurcation in the Democratic Party that we have in the Republican Party. In fact, the Democrats who come to the Senate from the House look a whole lot like the Democrats who don't come from the House. And so we can't see that same type of mentality. And clearly, there are liberal Democrats and there are moderate Democrats, but we can't trace their characteristics as cleanly as I can the Gingrich senators to their service in the House of Representatives.
Right. Thank you, Sean Theriault, for being with us and talking about your new book, The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. It's a pleasure being here today.
When we come back, how comedy and humor impact everything from our health to our societies. Stay tuned.
personally, I think healthcare should be free for all Americans. That's just my opinion. Yeah. For you guys who didn't clap, that means you can't relate. Let me tell you something. It's messed up when you're too broke to go to the doctors. You know you should be at the doctors, but instead you in CVS at 2 o'clock in the morning trying to diagnose yourself. You be walking in like, oh, shit. My kidneys are messed up. I better get me some NyQuil. I heard NyQuil is good for bad kidneys. Let me get some Tums for this tumor I got, too. You know, Tums is in the word tumors.
That was award-winning comic actor Reuben Paul. This is The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Humor affects many things: our health, our disposition, our relationships, and our organizations. Can it also help to change politics and society? With us are three experts. Amber Day is a professor of performance studies in the English and Cultural Studies Department at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate, and Breaking Boundaries in Politics and Political Entertainment Studies. John Morrill is professor of philosophy and department chair of religious studies at William & Mary College. He is the founder of International Society for Humor Studies and the author of Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, and The Philosophy of Laughter and Humor. Peter McGraw also joins us. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He directs the Humor Research Lab and co-directs the Moral Research Lab. He's the author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you. John Morrill, I'd like to start with you for a historic context. You've traced the origin of humor historically. You've looked at it even in animals. What does history tell us about humor?
Well, the current best theory, I think, of the evolution of humor is that it evolved from a rough-and-tumble kind of play in apes. Gorillas and chimpanzees, from whom we split in evolution about 6 million years ago, have a kind of laughter that's kind of hard to pick up because it's on the intake rather than the outtake. So instead of laughing ha-ha-ha, they laugh ah-ah-ah. It's kind of like panting. And what it accompanies is mock wrestling, chasing and biting, the kind of things that you do with a little kid. And just as with a little child, when chimps and gorillas chase each other and wrestle each other to the ground and pretend that they're aggressive, they give a signal that they're only playing, and that signal is laughter. So for me, the best theory of the evolution of laughter and humor is that they came from a kind of rough-and-tumble play where it was necessary that they signal to the other person, look, I'm not out to hurt you. I'm not out to break your skin when I pretend to bite you, for example. And that laughter was this play signal. You can see this today when somebody tries to be funny, but they don't give any indication that you're trying to be funny. Well, what that usually ends up in is being threatening. The great example of that was Andy Kaufman, who for years after he left Saturday Night Live went around the country challenging women to wrestle him and defeat him, but he didn't put it in any kind of play frame. He didn't give any comedic hints that he was only playing. So he would show up these wrestling places, and he'd have women who really took him seriously and really wanted to hurt him. So when we are playing and when we want to engage in humor, we need laughter to signal that we're only playing.
Peter McGraw.
So what John says is, I think, is absolutely right, that the origin of humor started with play, but as humans developed and started to have other sorts of rules, new linguistic rules and cultural rules and societal rules, the things that became threatening or that could become wrong started to expand. And so the things that we find funny now have moved beyond the physical. Now it can be toilet humor, things like puns, moving outside of that, satire, irony, sarcasm, and so on. And the work that we've been doing in the Humor Research Lab has identified an explanation for that, something that we call benign violations, that we tend to laugh at, we are delighted by, amused by situations that seem both wrong and okay, in the same way that rough and tumble play is playful and fun when it's both a violation, there's some threat, and then also some idea of, oh, this is okay, this is safe, this is playful. And so this evolution has moved up and branched out and has created what is really a complex yet exciting topic of research.
Amber Day, in your introduction, you look at various kinds of satire. And one of the things that you noted in your, I think it was in the literature review, was that it used to be really the art of the aristocrats. But now it's like a tool for the populist.
So that's how it sort of grossly gets characterized. I don't know that that's entirely true across the board. I think there was, for a long time, literary scholars considered it a conservative art form because it was used in that way. I think there's certainly examples that go against that grain. But there's definitely, you know, there's power in humor, and I think it can be used in either direction. So you can use it certainly to sort of put people in their place and remind them of the status quo and that they're stepping outside of it and using it for ridicule, and that tends to be from top down. But you can certainly also use it to question and to deconstruct the official line and, you know, to point out ironies, and that tends to be more of a sort of subversive bottom up.
Ironies, absurdities, but then, yes, you know, the idea of laughing at rather than laughing with.
Right. Which is certainly different than the sort of evolutionary start of it, in a way.
What's interesting, too, here when we talk about laughing at versus laughing with, I think it was Peter McGraw. I think you were the one who wrote the piece on partisanship and humor. First of all, it sounded like the left won the humor quotient, hands down, but they have different preferences for humor. Conservatives like one kind of humor and liberals like another. Can you break that down for us?
Certainly, the intuition is that the liberals win with regard to the being the funny, you know, the Democrats are the funny party. But I think to Amber's point, a lot of that is the sort of laughing at, the attacking the traditions and attacking those people in power. But when it comes to being funny, more generally, liberals and conservatives seem to be more equal. It's not clear that there's good evidence that liberals are funnier people. And some work done by Dan Ariely reveals that in some ways, depending on the topic, conservatives really have a much better time. I think that follows what we tend to find, this idea that benign violations is subjective. It depends on your values and your beliefs and your experiences. So what's funny to one person is not funny to another. And as a result, in some sense, everybody's funny. Everybody has equal opportunity to be funny, whether or not they're a liberal or a conservative.
And then, of course, there's just the infectiousness of Joe Biden laughing the entire time during his vice presidential debate with Paul Ryan.
Indeed. Yeah, and that's certainly a case where he was using laughter as ridicule.
So in this case, you think he was laughing at Paul Ryan?
Well, I think that he was using laughter to point out the ridiculousness, the absurdities of the things that Ryan was saying, and in a way that was designed to kind of resonate with his party.
John Morell, let's bring you back in here. Now, you've looked at this philosophically, and you say that we really value comic characters more than other types of heroes, like the tragic hero. First of all, tell us why that is, and then walk us through the Barack Obama kind of comic role.
Sure. One of the things that I've studied is the contrast between the heroic tradition, which lasted in American politics well into the 20th century. People like, well, take a turn of the century president like William Howard Taft or even the early Teddy Roosevelt. These people were frequently military veterans, or Eisenhower would be an even better example. These are people who were often military veterans, and they were part of a long tradition that goes back to the ancient Greeks, where the leader is somebody who tries to maximize power. They try to maximize their own knowledge. They try to be on top of everything, and they typically don't laugh very much at themselves. There's a newer style of leadership, which has grown up in the U.S. and throughout the world in the last 30 years or so, which I call post-heroic. And in this style of leadership, you don't emphasize the difference between you and the people you govern. In corporations, for example, in the last 30 years, they've leveled the pyramid. That is, that they've cut out a lot of the levels of organization. And so you see CEOs talking to ordinary people on the manufacturing line. The newer style of leadership tends to have a lot more humor in it. When I do talks like this for political groups and business groups, I often use William Howard Taft, who was not only a very kind of a stuffy president, but he was also our nation's fattest president. On the day of his inauguration, he weighed something over 300 pounds, and there was a new bathtub in the White House, and he got stuck in the tub, and it took four guys over 2 hours to extricate him from the tub. But he swore everybody to secrecy because he wouldn't want the population of the U.S. laughing at him. If you contrast that with somebody like Barack Obama, Obama isn't the funniest guy in the world, but he can certainly poke fun at himself. One of my favorite examples was between the time he was elected and his inauguration. He was in a press conference, and they were throwing him all kinds of tough questions about the economy, which was in a shambles, and all kinds of stuff. And finally, somebody threw him a softball question, and they said, "We hear that you're going to get a dog for the White House for your daughters. What kind of dog are you going to get?" And Obama said, "Well, at first we thought we wanted to get a mutt." And then he said, "Like me." And to me, that was just a watershed moment for a president to say a mutt and then like me, because he's half black, he's half white. It showed a guy who could poke fun at himself. And that kind of leadership is found not just in politics, but also in business. If you look at CEOs today, for example, versus, say, 50 years ago, they've removed the tie. A lot of them have also removed the sport jacket or the suit jacket. And the hero of this movement is Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines, who's built a very successful corporation, largely on his playfulness, his sense of humor, and his ability to link both of those to spirit of camaraderie and equality. Humor tends to level differences between people. So when a president or a CEO or your boss can engage in really open humor, I'm not talking about sarcasm or put down, but really open humor, everybody can relax and social relations go a lot better.
Amber Day, this is a perfect place to bring you in because you've looked at this as a form of dissent also, and you've studied all kinds of political dissent, whether it was satire or some other kinds of activism. How do you see this now shaping the political landscape with the new satirists in town?
Sure. I found that last point really interesting, and I kind of want to jump off of it, because I feel like it's not just in leadership, but it's become more of a cultural norm to sort of to use a kind of self-deprecating or self-referential irony. And that in many circles, that somehow kind of signals an honesty or a trustworthiness. I think that's partially because of the way in which political discourse, in particular the sort of public debate, is so kind of stage managed, so perfect, so shiny and fake in many ways, right? We all know the way it's staged, and yet there's this frustration in the way in which the press isn't doing the best job of getting through that, and getting past the talking points that have been pre-scripted and all of that. And so I think where a lot of the sort of interesting political satire is coming out these days, and the hunger for it, is this desire to see somebody actually kind of poke holes in that spectacle and do so in a way in which they're not necessarily an expert, but they're also kind of drawing attention to who they are and that they don't claim to be perfect and that they don't necessarily have all the answers. So there's a sort of humble irony employed there.
And you've noted that this has actually transformed at least some of our comics, our comedians, into really legitimate pundits, or at least semi-legitimate pundits.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, a figure like, Jon Stewart, of course, is the first one to come to mind, is quite different than what's come before. A few decades ago, Chevy Chase was everybody really liked his impression of the presidents and they liked his Weekend Update shtick, but you would never ask Chevy Chase seriously for his take on contemporary politics. Nobody would think of doing so, but Jon Stewart is doing something quite different than what Chevy Chase was doing.
Right, and Jon Stewart happens to be quite learned and well-read and brilliant at the same time, which perhaps is what makes a great comic.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think you can be funny in many different ways, but the way in which he's funny and the things that resonate are because he is really sort of revealing things. He's very good in particular at revealing the way in which, pulling back the curtain on some of that political debate and some of the staged nature of political discourse and really kind of watching how it, letting us watch how it's put together in a way that's incredibly satisfying, I think.
Peter McGraw, that sort of touches on something that was in one of your blogs, which deals with the humor being sort of counter-establishment by its nature. And how do you see that fitting in with today's politics?
One of the roots of sort of stand-up comedy is entertainment, comes out of the motif of the trickster, of the court jester. And on my Humor Code travels, my co-author Joel Warner and I met with Patch Adams. And I can't repeat the language that Patch used, but he basically said that the court jester is the only person who can call the king a jack, you know. And so he actually used more flavorful language than that. And that tradition continues today, where comedians, stand-up or otherwise, are taking aim at the things that are wrong with the traditions, with the people in power, with government, with media. And the Jon Stewarts of the world, they happen to be doing it, you know, better than anyone else, in part because Jon Stewart is really adept. He's quick on his feet. He's a quick thinker. He also has a writer's room full of very funny Harvard graduates who are helping him out along the way. And the very best comedians that we found on the road are ones that can take aim at themselves, as John and Amber mentioned, in part to increase that level of credibility, that if they can make fun of themselves, then they certainly can make fun of all these other things that are wrong in the world.
John Morrell, let's bring you back in then. You've talked about the benefits of humor. It helps us individually. You've talked about various ways it helps organizations. How do you think it's beneficial for politics of the world?
It's interesting that the beginning of comedy was in the 5th century BCE in Athens, Greece, and the beginning of democracy was in 5th century Athens, Greece, 5th century BCE. I think that there's a very strong link between people being able to joke about their leaders, to poke fun at their shortcomings, their hypocrisy, their screw-ups, etc., and their political freedom. So I think that there's a strong link between open societies and democratic values and this ability to have people like Jon Stewart around. If you look at countries that are repressive, if you look, for example, at several countries in the Middle East, where joking about the leader can get you executed, you see the opposite of this. And in the West, probably the strongest example of somebody who repressed humor was Hitler. When Hitler was rising to power in the late 20s and early 30s, the first people who criticized him were stand-up comedians. At that time, they were called cabaret comics. And when Hitler came to power in 1933, one of the first things that he did was establish special courts for prosecuting people who made fun of his Third Reich or made fun of the brown shirts or made fun of the way the Nazis were told to march, etc. And over 100 people were executed. One stand-up comic in Berlin, for example, was hanged for naming his horse Adolf. If you look at the Soviet Union, there was a similar pattern. The Soviet Union wanted to control humor and suppress humor that was critical of the leader. And they even set up a special journal, which came out every 10 days in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it had a larger circulation than Time magazine and Newsweek magazine put together in this country, and it was called Crocodile. And what they allowed humor about was inefficiency, bureaucratic red tape, people being drunk on the job, people not doing their work. But what they didn't allow was jokes about the leadership. So the secretary of the Communist Party was never a legitimate target. So governments have known since the days of ancient Egypt, when the first court jesters were in place, that humor is powerful, and humor may be playful, but it can be playfully critical. And so governments that are more open allow for more humor. Governments that are more controlled and repressive are afraid of humor.
Amber Day, I don't recall if you actually had this in your literature or in your book, but can you tell us what kind of a measurable impact some of these new, what you called Renaissance comics, are making in society in America today or in the other countries that you looked at?
The short answer is no, but I think, yes, the problem is sort of how do you measure that effect, and that's the hardest thing to do, right? And I think we tend to sort of look at it very simplistically and say, well, is this one piece going to have a measurable effect on the next election? And the answer is usually no, of course it isn't. But I think these comics and, you know, a number of the filmmakers, the activists that I'm looking at are making a difference and they are doing something. But I think it's smaller. I think it's shifting the conversation in small ways, changing the terms in which we talk about particular issues, slowly, or even actually pushing issues that were very peripheral and only sort of talked about in you know, marginal counterpublics, pushing those further into the wider public sphere and into the wider discussion. And I think that's huge. And that's the kind of thing, these shifts have to happen before change ever takes place, right? Because sort of public perception has to change, but it is the stuff that's incredibly hard to actually track and measure.
We do know from the, I think it's the Pew studies, that The Daily Show was certainly the leading source of news, political news for young people, particularly through the election periods.
Right.
Perhaps we should take a little shift and talk about, well, what makes things funny? And this is something that you've all looked at as well. Peter McGraw, that's kind of the whole subject of your institute. Why don't you start us with this? Why are some things funny and some things not?
So, yeah, so I recognize that some of my theorizing isn't always popular as a kind of outsider moving into this field. My expertise is in judgment and decision-making and the study of emotion more generally. And when I stumbled on this question, I surveyed the research, including John's work, and found hints at different perspectives, one that's different than the traditional view of humor arising from some form of incongruity, that there's some mismatch between what we expect and what we get in the world. As I mentioned earlier, I, based on my reading, came to the conclusion that actually humor has a counterintuitive underpinning, that of something negative, what we call a violation. And luckily, there's support for this by people a lot smarter than me. Mark Twain has a great quote where he says that the secret source of humor is not joy, it's sorrow. There is no humor in heaven. That is because because heaven's perfect, there's nothing actually to laugh at. And the studies that we've been doing in the Humor Research Lab seems to help support that idea. But of course, the things that are violations don't normally amuse us. They upset us. And so you have to have this other judgment, this recognition that the situation is safe or acceptable or okay, or as we say, to not.
So then it really could collapse into the tragic.
So the tragic is actually a really good source of humor in many ways, but it also keeps with a saying that's at least been attributed to Mark Twain, that the humor is tragedy plus time, that as time passes, as you get some distance from the thing that's bad, it helps transform it from a violation into a benign violation.
And John Morrell, would you agree?
Yes. Peter's notion of a benign violation fits fairly well with the traditional theory called the incongruity theory, which says that in a humorous situation, something violates your expectations. You expect A and you get not A, or even better, you get the opposite of A. So your expectations are violated. That's part one. And part two is you don't go into a negative emotion. You don't get scared. You don't become sad or depressed. You're not disgusted or angry. Instead, you are able to enjoy the incongruity. You're able to enjoy this surprise. Humans are the only ones who can pull this off. You can surprise your cat, for example, by moving her food dish to a different spot in the kitchen. You can dress up in a funny Halloween costume in front of your dog, but you'll never get a laugh out of either one of them. So humans are the only ones who can experience something that they weren't ready for, even the opposite of what they were ready for. And even including their own disappointments and their own mistakes, and somehow enjoy it. They can have their mental train derailed and enjoy the train wreck. So Peter's notion of a violation which is safe or okay or benign, I think it works very well. And you notice that in some situations, the same event which surprises, say, a room full of people, will make some of them angry and others of them amused. So I think there's a personal difference between people who go into a negative emotion versus people who go into laughter instead. And that's basically what Peter referred to quickly as distance. I call it mental distance. People who can laugh about things typically see it from a higher perspective. They step back. They're less emotionally engaged. People who tend to experience everything with anger or fear or sadness or depression tend to be emotionally wrapped up in things. And that's the heart of tragedy. The difference between tragedy and comedy isn't the subject matter in comedy and in tragedy. The subject matter is disappointment and failure and suffering and death and our inability to understand what's happening to us. Comedy isn't about happy, successful people doing well. It's about the same thing tragedy is about. But the tragic character goes into her emotions. She gets swept away by them. The comic character steps back and thinks her way rather than feels her way through her problems.
Amber Day.
I would just add to that a little bit, but I don't think we should see comedy, humor, irony as completely removed from the serious or the feeling or, you know, feeling very strongly about something. Because there tends to be this assumption that, you know, somebody like Jon Stewart, well, it's bad for politics, right? It's cynical. And, you know, we're just laughing at it. We're not really caring about it. And I spend a lot of time sort of pushing against that assumption because I think what's really interesting about a lot of the political humor in particular that we see right now is a lot of it is actually very earnest, you know, and it's being used to rile us up to some degree, particularly in some of the activist groups that I take a look at, or some of the viral videos that we see circulating before an election. They tend to use irony and humor and satire to get our attention and to grab us. And I think there is that aspect of the benign violation because the satisfaction comes in knowing, wow, somebody else notices this, right? Somebody else is seeing this. And that makes me feel a little bit better. But I think the intended effect, a lot of the time, if it is being used to garner attention or to actively get people involved in something, is to get them to feel like to get them mad, really, or to get them upset about it, and feel like there are other people who are laughing at the same thing and who are upset about the same thing, and that there's sort of that strength in numbers.
Thank you, all three of you, for joining us. John Morrell, Amber Day, Peter McGraw, it's great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Amber Day is a professor of performance studies in the English and Cultural Studies Department at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate, and Breaking Boundaries in Politics and Political Entertainment Studies. John Morrell is professor of philosophy and department chair of religious studies at William & Mary College. He is the founder of International Society for Humor Studies and the author of Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, and The Philosophy of Laughter and Humor. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He directs the Humor Research Lab and co-directs the Moral Research Lab. He's the author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, and Cuauhtemoc Gailemen. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.